Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Mark Lehner about his first work of fiction in almost 15 years.
It's not as if this book just came out sort of like a C-section. There was labor and gestation and all of that. So,
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Novelist and critic Meg Wolitzer walks us through the controversy surrounding women's fiction today.
While women and men will read books about the lives of men, very few men will read books about the lives of women. And that's a problem for serious women writers.
Tim Weiner discusses the strange career of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI.
I think it's incredibly exciting. And it is full of stories that you just couldn't make up. No fiction writer could make up J. Edgar Hoover.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Mark Lehner is one of America's most inventive and risky fiction writers. He has a new book, his first in quite some time. We'll talk about that. It's called The Sugar-Frosted Nutsack. It's reviewed for us by Ben Marcus, who says, Lehner demonstrates how much is still possible for the novel when tradition is left behind, proving that fiction can be robust, provocative, and staggeringly inventive without for a moment forfeiting entertainment. I'm glad, delighted that Mark is here to talk about his new book. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you may as well hang it up. That's it. You've accomplished what every novelist since Joyce has wanted to do, so get into another line of work.
It's occurred to me. There's something culminative about this, the culminating act somehow or other. It's an interesting remark because it is a kind of maybe more psychological than aesthetic tactic to think of each book of mine as the last. I didn't experience this protracted hiatus that's kind of taking on a more mystical, thanks to me, taking on a more mystical and mythic tone to it. It didn't seem that long to me, but then suddenly when I looked up, you know, it had been quite a while. I guess it's something like 13, 14 years. I mean, it's not as if this book just came out sort of like a C-section. There was labor and gestation and all of that. So,
well, readers will be relieved to know that this is like your other books, only this time we start with the very beginning of the universe.
Yeah, and there's a major crucial difference in that I'm not sure if all of the other books, but certainly in A Two Babe, in The Tetherballs of Bougainville, these being earlier books of mine, there was a character named Mark Lehner in them. And that was something I played with a lot back then. And this is scrupulously purged of at least my name. I wouldn't say scrupulously purged of me. It's not.
Well, you're still in it. We have...
It's infested with me.
Yes, we have a god that uses a drug called gravy. What's gravy?
Gravy is, well, I variously describe it as a kind of hallucinogenic borscht. It's one theory. Another is much more mundane, that it's more akin to huffing whiteout or something. So we don't know quite. There are theories. It is something that the gods and goddesses partake of, and also something that mortals can occasionally partake of to be most enlightened.
So this has overtones of some truly classical literature. We have gods and mortals. We have the origins of the universe. When you sit down to write a novel like this, do you have any idea where you're going when you start?
I had an idea that I wanted to write something about gods and goddesses, unprecedented gods and goddesses, meaning that it would not be parodic in any way. And that was a pretty difficult thing. you know, because one's reflexes and instincts, even trying to avoid a parody of something that's so much an integral part of our culture and our thinking, is tricky. It's really tricky. But that was an idea I had. Beyond that, no. And actually, the more crucial things in the book, I think, which are the bards who repeat this and create an ever more elaborate incantatory version of this book, didn't come into my head until I was pretty well into the book.
When did you start writing it?
I'm terribly inaccurate retrospectively, but I think I started writing it two, three years ago, I'd say.
You once said something to me in conversation I'm sure you won't remember. This is when we worked together around the time your last novel had come out in the late 90s when I was an editor at the Op-Ed Page. And we had lunch and we were talking about politics, I think. And you said, and I've repeated this to many people because I realize it's true of me. You said, I always believe the last person I've talked to. Is that a useful attribute for a fiction writer?
In the end, no, I would say. I think it served me well at a certain time in my life. I think it serves you better when you're younger. I think in every walk of life, you know. I think believing what the last person on the street or at a party or in your home, the very last comment will bode well for you as you get older, I think. One of the things I did with this book that I had never done before is really show none of the work to anyone and talk about it to no one for pretty much the duration of the process of writing it.
How did you used to do it? Show drafts?
Well, or? In the olden days, I probably would show a little section to people or some pages. Also, I would do a reading now and then, and which enabled me to test drive a portion of it and get a sense of how people were reacting. And this time, I really didn't want to do that. Since it had been a while, since I had been doing things that were much more collaborative, I wanted this book to be implacably strange. And I thought that the way to make this implacably strange was to soak in my own marinade throughout, you know, to make all the decisions, all those anguished little decisions, of which there are thousands a day when you're working on something, to make them by myself and to create some kind of logical machine that would transport me through this whole thing without recourse to anyone. Because the trouble with showing work, and I'll continue to do this now because I think it worked in this book. The trouble with showing something to someone is not that they'll say something critical and sort of throw you off your game in some way. It's more that they'll say there'll be some kind of approbation and you'll key on that. It's a little like what we were talking before with listening to the last person. That's why I went off on this. Because as a kind of human being who yearns for affection, I will think, oh, so I showed them a part about this God or in this tone or riffing in this way, and they liked it, so I need to do more of that. And it becomes a significantly mediating factor in your thinking about something, even if it's very positive. So I just wanted to eliminate that possibility.
What's the collaborative work you've been doing? So listeners will get a sense of what you've
been doing. The collaborative work which I was doing, which I would prefer to do much less of, if any at all, was some screenwriting and script doctoring, as they call it, and things like that. That's basically the way, aside from fiction, over the past dozen years I've supported myself.
So I have to ask you the inevitable question, and what is the influence or advantage or detriment of doing that kind of work versus fiction? You've told us one thing, which is now you're no collaboration at all. It's just you. But does your fiction begin to take on any of the coloration of the other work you've done, do you think?
I would say no. I think I wrote this book in large part as a furious repudiation of that collaborative endeavor over those years. I mean, I had really come to the point where I found a lot of it despicable and sad for me. You know, I just didn't like doing it anymore. And this book represents my, it's my revenge.
Did you like it at all? Did you like it at first? Yeah, I remember when we first talked about it, you were interested.
There are aspects of it. There are aspects of it. And I certainly don't mean to characterize people out in Hollywood in any broad way. There are wonderful people there. But it's just something that I don't know why it took me so long to realize, but it's just something that I am psychologically, it's not congenial to my ways as a human being of navigating the world, of doing my work. You know, it's very social, it's hyper collaborative, and we haven't even talked about the business aspects of it, the mercenary aspects of it, but just in a social sense. It's not the way I like to live. I mean, I wouldn't have become a writer if I didn't have an overwhelming hermetic predilection, you know. And suddenly to be tossed into meetings in hotel lobbies every day and that sort of thing, it ultimately became insufferable. That's not to say it isn't fun on a given evening when the sun's setting to have been put up in some posh hotel, sit on the balcony and have a martini and think, look at me, you know. But ultimately, I didn't feel so good looking at me in that mirror.
And now you're back, World of Fiction, and welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's Mark Lehner, whose new novel, The Sugar Frosted Nutsack, is reviewed in this week's book review.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business by Charles Duhigg. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview. That's audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Well, Julie, Harry Potter is back, kind of.
Kind of, in digital form. And this has taken a very long time. All of Harry Potter's fans, young and old, have been waiting a really long time for this. And J.K. Rowling finally announced this week that if you want to buy an ebook edition of one of the 7 Harry Potter books, you can do so. However, the arrangement through which you have to do that is very unusual for the publishing industry.
Well, let's get into that. First of all, it's interesting that it should be the author herself, however famous, who's announcing the books are available in e-form and not her publisher. Does that mean that she, as she did with the Harry Potter films, is really exerting tight control over this?
She is. J.K. Rowling retained the digital rights to the Harry Potter series many years ago when they were first published. I mean, this is something that's pretty unique. I mean, if you were to get a book deal right now, almost any publisher would say, I'm not signing this book deal unless I can have both the digital and the print rights at the same time. They don't slice those up anymore.
Well, that's kind of far-sighted of her to have seen back in the 90s that this would be an entirely different way for her to present what became like the world's biggest literary franchise.
Maybe she had no desire to publish the digital editions, and it just took her a very long time to decide to do that. You know, these books, of course, were famous for getting a lot of kids hooked on hardcover books because they wanted the books so badly when they came out that they were willing to go to a bookstore at midnight and dress up in costume and stand there and pay what the hardcover book cost. And a lot of people in the industry believe that the Harry Potter books are responsible for getting a lot of kids who are now in their 20s hooked on hardcover books, which is a very nice buying habit to have for a publisher or for an author anyway, because they're so much more expensive.
Okay, so if I want to read a Harry Potter novel digitally, how do I do it?
Well, you can't just go on to Amazon.com and buy with one click or download to your Kindle or to BNN.com and buy it on your Nook. You have to go to a website that J.K. Rowling started, which is called Pottermore. And this website will eventually have online gaming aspects. It'll be interactive. But for now, it's essentially a retail website, and it sells the digital and the audiobooks of the Harry Potter series. Now, when you go to Pottermore, you can send those downloaded books back to your Kindle device or your Nook device or your smartphone or your laptop.
Does that mean then she has some kind of arrangement, say, with Barnes & Noble and Amazon? Amazon controls and patrols the Kindle very closely. So she's worked out an arrangement whereby you can get it sent to your Kindle, even though you're not ordering from Amazon.
That's right. You know, J.K. Rowling doesn't sell any devices of her own, so she...
Not yet, anyway.
She had to solve that problem. So she did say, yes, these e-books can be read on the Kindle, on the Nook, on the Sony Reader, on computers and tablets and cell phones, and she struck deals with those companies who were, of course, very eager to get that book available. And they made quite an exception. I mean, there aren't that many books on Amazon.com where Amazon will send the customer to a third-party website like Pottermore and then try to get them to download the book because they don't get that sale.
And what is the sale price? What's the cost of one of these novels? Do we know?
Well, the first books, the first three books in the series are priced at $7.99 each, and the last four, which are a little bit longer, are $9.99 each.
And Julie, do we have a sense whether young readers are comfortable reading on tablets or Kindles? They don't still prefer the actual bound book in their hands?
It's still early days. I mean, I think that you hear anecdotally that a lot of kids who are, you know, tweens or teens have started to get e-readers for Christmas gifts and birthday gifts and have started to pick up these devices. But there's also a lot of evidence to indicate that kids still really like print books and that a lot of educators are resistant to having kids reading on these devices, and a lot of parents, for that matter. So when you look at children's books overall and see how much digital growth there has been, it really hasn't been that much, certainly not nearly as much as adult trade books, which right now are at least 20% of total revenues for most publishers.
Well, we'll have to see how she does on our ebook bestseller list.
We'll find out.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Almost 50 years after Betty Friedan wrote The Feminine Mystique, there is a debate that continues to roil the literary world, and that is about the different types of attention and seriousness that are accorded to fiction by men versus fiction by women. And a very good novelist, Meg Wolitzer, has written a provocative and ambitious essay for us. It's called The Second Shelf, and she's here to talk about it. Welcome, Meg.
Thank you.
Okay, let's start with a very simple question. What do people mean by women's fiction?
I think they mean a couple of different kinds of things. It's a term used to describe fiction that is sort of aiming right for the female market, not too difficult, quick reads, things you want to pick up and just sort of whip through. I think that that's one way of describing it. There's another term, women's fiction, that I think is a misnomer. And a lot of really good literary novelists who don't think about their audience, don't want their audience to be only female. Their books are often described as women's fiction too, which is a great puzzlement.
And why are they? I mean, however mistakenly, what are the criteria being used? That it's about relationships, their domestic novels. What's the general category?
Well, first of all, they're written by women. And I think that that is actually the most important thing. I mean, I recently had an experience in which somebody invited me to speak at a lunch and was going to invite a couple of different novelists. And they all were very, very different. And he said, you know, women's fiction. It'll be women's fiction. And I was offended by that because the novels had nothing in common. It was just that they were written by women. Sometimes I think that there's a kind of interiority to the novels that people call women's fiction, which are literary. They're about the way people feel. They're about the way women feel often. That actually is, I think, also a criterion. They're about the way women feel. And it struck me over the years, really, the sort of strangeness of the fact that while women and men will read books about the lives of men, very few men will read books about the lives of women. And that's a problem for serious women writers.
Okay, Meg, now let's get into the area of literary criticism, because that's where a lot of this is really exploding now as a controversy, that more men than women seem to be reviewing books, including in our publication, though according to the numbers, we actually do better than most others. And there's the question as well whether even really serious and highly knowledgeable, erudite literary critics will approach a novel by Ann Tyler or Laurie Moore differently from the way they might approach a novel by Jonathan Franzen or Jonathan Lethem. Is there something to this?
Sometimes there is. It's hard to say. This is a really tough topic. You don't look good talking about it as a writer. I mean, that's part of the
problem. But you sound great.
Thank you. I sound great. I've thought about it a lot over the years because I think things have changed. I mean, to take the long way around your question, when I first started writing, it was a very, very exciting time in fiction in this country. And those critics who you're describing were talking about writers like Louise Erdrich, Bobby Ann Mason.
So we're talking about, what, the 80s,
the 90s? Early 80s, really. Late 70s to early 80s. This was kind of a thrilling moment because it really seemed like women's voices mattered and would actually get equal attention. And then I think as the women's movement became less of a sort of national priority and less fashionable somehow, the need to look at these lives, which had in some cases been sort of marginalized, became less. So then what happened with fiction and with critics of fiction is that some of these books started to look small to these writers. Whereas when I came up, if you recall, speaking of small, even in terms of size, actually, a book like Monkeys by Susan Minot, also the 80s, I think, was a huge smash. Men and women read it. Everybody talked about it. It was a short, very, very short book about girls and housekeeping, actually, which, of course, brilliant novel, which came out, I think, in 1980, was about two girls and their aunt. I wonder if housekeeping came out now, I wonder if it would really make the same splash. I really don't know. It seemed that that was an era that critics were more willing to open themselves to things that previously they had thought of as maybe not as important.
Well, you know, it's interesting when I was first getting involved in all of this and trying to make sense of the literary world, it seemed to me, and this is a period you're talking about maybe even a little earlier, that the two novelists or fiction writers who were the most obvious heirs of Hemingway were Anne Beattie and Joan Didion. Yeah. They wrote with the same kind of precision and understatement, very powerful irony, also captured generational changes. And you're right. Somehow that approach, even to these really major writers, isn't as much a part of the critical conversation.
No, it really isn't, because you look at a book like, do you remember Speedboat by Renata Adler? It was about two pages long. It was like a haiku. That, again, was a big, big deal. The Lover by Marguerite Duras. I mean, these were huge deals. They were intense, short books. Joan Didion's nonfiction, has remained really, really essential. And I think people read it a lot more than they do read her fiction. But it's problematic because as a writer, you don't want to think about the reader. You don't want to think about the critic. You don't want to think about the reader. You want to think about at least in my case, I want to write the book I want to find on the shelf.
Let me throw another name out at you. Say, Cynthia Ozick. Is her work approached in the way that a man's fiction might? I mean, in some ways, she seems to belong to the tradition of Saul Bellow and Philip Roth, very cerebral.
Yes. I think she is unusual in this case. She's really a public intellectual, and I love her fiction, but her novel that came out, Foreign Bodies, I guess, you know, which I loved, really, I didn't hear a lot about it, again, in the culture, as if I live in the culture, the big dinner party in which I live. I didn't hear people talking about it in that same way, and I suspect it's because she was part of that moment much more. When Levitations came out, that was very exciting. People did talk about her, but again, it sort of drifted away, whereas I think some of the male writers now remain fashionable in a different way. Well, the new generation of them, they...
Let's deal in some really obvious gender cliches now. I'm going to throw some questions at you. Is it possible that a novelist like Jonathan Franzen is just kind of better at creating attention for himself than a novelist like Laurie Moore, who, for instance, in our pages, Jonathan Lethem essentially said is the fiction writer of this period for his generation? I think many male writers would say that she is the finest artist, the most admired writer of sentences, the deepest sense of, you know, really powerful irony and humor. But is a guy like Franzen just better at making the culture notice him?
I don't know if it's just that he's better at it, but the people around him are better at it too. I mean, it's really kind of a big process that starts with how your publisher makes your book look, you know, your name.
Yes, talk about that, because you have a fair amount about that in your essay,
yeah,
about these jumbo titles that announce, you know, the lettering on that
right
is so big, The Corrections, Freedom,
right,
this
right
is a big book.
Well, we've been that way about lettering. I mean, since we were kids, and I remember the lettering of the TV show The Man from U.N.C.L.E. when the credits came on, and there's this sort of sexy, exciting feeling that you feel. When I read The Corrections, and it had those gigantic letters that basically imprinted themselves in my frontal lobe, if that's where they would do that, I felt excited. And as I started reading it, I continued to feel that way, because I think he's a wonderful writer, and I think he's a good stylist, and I think he writes about big things. And it wasn't surprising that it caught on in that way, but other people had to get on board and say, look, this is important. And I think it is, and I think it should have gotten that attention, but I think there are other writers who should get a lot more attention too. And yeah, I mean, I feel that sometimes women's novels can look quieter. They can look quieter. There's a sort of softness in the illustration, as though, even though we're not calling them women's fiction in that first way that I described, the kind of, I know I want a simple, quick read aimed for women, the publisher is saying there's something aesthetically pleasing, perhaps to women, in the soft image. And I've noticed, actually, something that I didn't put in this piece, but I've subsequently noticed that there are a lot of novels by women that have covers of girls in water, girls in kind of an aquamarine background. It's a very sort of seductive, soothing image. And you don't see that really so much with a lot of novels by men, which feel that they have more of a gravitas and a kind of, I am asserting myself in the world, as opposed to a sort of aesthetic entrance.
And now we're getting into something different here, Meg. We're talking about really the marketplace and decisions that book publishers, editors, art directors, marketing people make about how to reach women. And here's the paradox that underlies all of this is it's women who are reading almost all the novels.
I know. That is really the problem here. But, you know, I read a quote from the editor of the TLS who said, who was aware of the gender difference in the contents of their issues, and said, in terms of the reviews, something like, well, a lot of the books, the problem is that a lot of the books that women want to read are not the kind of books that we want to review in these pages, that are appropriate to review in these pages, something like that. I don't know the quote exactly, but I was surprised by that. And I wondered, well, that's a really broad statement to make. And what's behind that? Do you know those books? Have you read those books? Are you making assumptions based on what you've heard about them, or more to the point, haven't heard about them? Because they can be seen as smaller, even though they're very powerful. There was a novel by Venda Levita called The Lovers that I loved. I absolutely loved this book. It was very short. It was very moving to me. And I didn't see it get a lot of traction in the world, but it was very emotional.
You reviewed it quite prominently, but you're right. It did not have the impact another novel might have.
Right.
Or I'm thinking of Emily Barton's novel Brooklyn,
yeah,
which was much, much admired, but didn't establish itself in the culture.
No. You know, you can't get people to read things they don't want to read. I mean, that is partly true. You can't force them to do that. Things can't become a big hit unless people talk about them with each other.
Fair enough. But now I'm going to take the other side here.
Okay.
I'm going to be a would-be feminist here and say, but wait a minute, isn't that – we're not just talking about huge commercial success. We're talking about, as you said, getting traction in, let's say, the intellectual culture. Isn't that the job of our great critics?
It absolutely is the job of our great critics.
And are they letting us down?
I think they often are. I think they're reviewing men far more frequently. They are sometimes ignoring books that I think people would love and should know about. Whether those books would take off, again, who knows? That the strange X factor that happens in the culture, we can't really control that. But I think they should take a look at books that seem like outliers, that books that seem more idiosyncratic, perhaps smaller. You know, something happened in the culture after 9/11. I mean, I feel that this is a larger issue about fiction. People started to become so frightened and anxious that they wanted to know about the world around them. And they felt often, in my sense, that you could find out about the world more from nonfiction. So I think nonfiction became more significant, and fiction became sort of more of a luxury item, more of a kind of indulgence. So fiction that seems to speak directly to the culture, that speaks directly to the large anxieties of the culture, feel maybe like they have more of a place today, those novels. And my sense, of course, is that a culture that doesn't need fiction is in big trouble.
Well, I'm reminded of something one of the greatest of literary critics said long ago, Lionel Trilling, when he wrote his little book on E.M. Forster, published during World War II, written in 6 weeks, I think in 1942 or 43. He said, it's at a moment like this, with the world in crisis, that the great thing fiction does, and a novel like Forster's, which we might even think of as being women's fiction,
right,
actually has deeper truths to reveal. And so, and it reminds me of yet something else. I was a tremendous admirer of Claire Massoud's novel, The Emperor's Children. I think it, in some ways, was the great 9/11 novel,
right,
because like Franzen's The Corrections, it showed you the world destroyed by 9/11. Yet whenever it seemed to me, whenever I recommended it to women friends, they didn't like it. They said, I didn't like any of the characters.
Well, that is something that makes you crazy as a writer, as though characters are there to be your friends, as though it's a slumber party, and that's a bad thing.
I hear this a lot from very serious women readers. They will judge a book that way. True?
Well, I've heard it actually from writers who have told me that their editors have said this to them. And that's bothered me. I haven't heard it the way that you're describing it, but it is troubling, yes. As though a book is meant to be there to be your friend. It's like a therapist, you know, buying a therapist friend. No, a book is not your friend. These people are not your friends. You enter into the world of a novel to be marinating in that world, to learn about the writer's sensibility. Zadie Smith has a great line about something about writing to express her way of being in the world.
Right.
The characters in Claire Massoud's novel, yes, were often very self-involved, but I thought the book was terrific. I loved it too. And the thing about that book, I loved coming back to it every night when the day ended. It had a big heft to it. It had a big scope to it. It had characters who, no, mostly you didn't like. I mean, I think in most novels, some character almost takes on the role of the reader's perspective. Someone, you know, a dog in Chekhov, somebody there has to be the kind of humanizing presence in a way so that the reader doesn't feel entirely lost. I mean, that's not always true. But I'm surprised to hear that, I guess. Not shocked, but it's troubling because I think you have to do that thing that, well, John Updike said this great line, but it was about criticism, that when he was reviewing a book, he felt the need to submit to the spell of the story. And I think that that's what you have to do when you read a novel.
He also said novelists are not obligated to like their characters.
No, they are absolutely not. I don't think that way. There are a lot of ways that I think readers think that writers never think. Readers are always saying to me and to other people, what do you think happened to the characters after the story? And to my thinking, it's sort of like a novel is like The Truman Show. There's this sort of glass surface, this dome in which my characters live, and then it ends and it doesn't go any further. I don't know. Sometimes I like my characters. Sometimes they're very annoying, like a lot of the people I know in life.
Let's go back to a much earlier period when feminism was just the gleam in the eye of Mary Shelley or someone. We look at really great novelists like Jane Austen and George Eliot, hugely ambitious writers. There's a misconception now that Jane Austen was only read by women in the early 19th century. Untrue. Her reputation was made by the great literary men of the period, like Thackeray, who recognized her right away as a genius, Sir Walter Scott. This was the great novelist. George Eliot, you know, in the criticism of F.R. Leavis, George Eliot is the giant in the British novel.
Right.
In his view, a greater novelist than Dickens. Now, how could those women operate in the way they did, on the scale they did, and not get pigeonholed the way it seems to be happening today?
Well, you know, the way Austen described her own work was interesting because she had that line about writing on little pieces.
2 inches of ivory.
Of 2 inches of ivory, right? So she behaved modestly about it, but it showed such great depth and understanding of the human experience. And that is what you look for in a novel. It's amazing. Those novels last. They absolutely last. And they're very unusual if you look at the sweeping history of, you know, 3 centuries of writing.
Thanks so much, Meg.
Thank you.
That's Meg Wolitzer, whose essay, The Second Shelf, appears in this week's book review. Tim Weiner is one of America's great reporters and writers on American intelligence. He's got a new book. It's called Enemies, A History of the FBI. It's reviewed for us by Kevin Baker, who says this is an important and disturbing new book. And he says, Weiner has done prodigious research, yet tells this depressing story with all the verve and coherence of a good spy thriller. I'm delighted that Tim is here to talk about his book. Welcome.
Thank you, Sam.
Why is the FBI's history so depressing?
You know, it's not. I think it's incredibly exciting, and it is full of stories that you just couldn't make up. No fiction writer could make up J. Edgar Hoover.
Well, let's start with Hoover. Tell us about him. How bizarre was he?
I don't think he was a monster. I think he was a Machiavelli. I think he was a guy who learned how to use power better than anybody in Washington under presidents from Woodrow Wilson to Richard Nixon. And this book is essentially about what happens when America becomes a world power, a superpower, after World War I, and how its Secret Intelligence Service, which is what the FBI is to presidents, it's not cops and robbers, it's spies, saboteurs, and people who want to blow up America and change the American political system, how presidents use this power, that is the story of J. Edgar Hoover.
So take us back to Woodrow Wilson and the young J. Edgar Hoover. What was he doing back then?
As American troops are landing in France in the summer of 1917.
World War I.
Right. J. Edgar Hoover joins the Justice Department. He's 22 years old. By the time he's 25, he's running the biggest counterterrorism operation in American history, arresting thousands of suspected anarchists, Bolsheviks, people who were opposed to the war, pacifists, rounding them up in dragnets by the thousands. Before he turns 30, he gets control of the FBI, and he runs the FBI from 1924 to 1972, 48 years. Nothing like it in American history.
What about Hoover? Let's talk about some presidents, Hoover and Franklin Roosevelt. What was their relationship like?
FDR loved Hoover because he loved secrets and he loved secret power, and he was quite an aficionado of intelligence. He calls Hoover into the White House one-on-one in 1936 and says, Edgar, I want you to develop a very clear picture of communists and fascists in this country. And Edgar says, yes, sir. In order to do that, I'll need to wiretap, bug, break into their houses, and spy on them. And Roosevelt says, you go right ahead.
Now, how legal is this?
Not.
So why was he able to do it?
Because he's the president of the United States, and he's defending the country. Stalin's on the rise in Russia. Hitler's on the rise in Germany. Everybody knew the Japanese were going to come at some point. They were fighting the Chinese. By 1939, we know there's going to be a war. It's on in Europe. The Supreme Court outlaws wiretapping. President Roosevelt, in writing, tells Hoover to go right on ahead to protect the national security of the United States. Again, power, raw power, exercised through the FBI.
Tim, you've been a great reporter for many years. How do you research a book like this? This isn't information people voluntarily give you.
Well, in one case it is. The FBI has always been a pyramid of paper, but some of that paper has been buried and classified secret, top secret, and above top secret for many years. Just after I finished my last book, Legacy of Ashes, A History of the CIA, I got a call from a lawyer who said, hey, guess what? I just won a 27-year-old Freedom of Information Act suit against the FBI for Hoover's intelligence files. Would you like them? Yes, I said, I would very much like them. The FBI has had a secret oral history program for many years, and they've just declassified in the last year about 208 of them. Incredible reading of careers of FBI who worked intelligence from World War II until after 9/11.
How big was the FBI at its peak? How big
it is at its peak?
Is it now? Yeah. How big an organization is it?
30,000 strong plus.
How much of that system, that bureaucracy, was created by Hoover himself? Was he a master of this?
He was, among other things, the greatest bureaucrat of the 20th century. He's now been gone for 40 years. It'll be 40 years next month. The institution he built is more powerful, more adept. It's not all white guys in ties anymore, but it is his institution. He is the man who created the modern surveillance state. And every time we go out in the street in New York or London and a camera looks down over our shoulders, every time we go through an airport and our biometric data, our eyeballs and fingerprints are recorded, that's the system Hoover built.
What was the relationship between the FBI and the CIA, say, during the Cold War?
Dreadful.
How come?
Because Hoover hated the CIA. They were rivals. He wanted to run America's Global Intelligence Service. And he thought the CIA were, you know, a bunch of cookie pushers. And they fought tooth and nail, and they continued to fight tooth and nail until September 11th, 2001. And their fighting was one of the proximate causes of the success of those attacks. They wouldn't share information.
And has that been addressed in a meaningful way?
Yes, because everybody knew within an hour after the attacks what their jobs were going to be for the next 10 years. Counterterrorism, intelligence, secret intelligence operations, counterterrorism operations are job one at the FBI, and job two, and job three, and job four.
Tim, what about J. Edgar Hoover and the Kennedys?
Hoover had a problem with Bobby Kennedy, who was the Attorney General of the United States. Hoover had taken over the FBI in 1924. Bobby Kennedy was born in 1925. And Hoover didn't want to have this young whippersnapper telling him what to do. They fought hammer and tong every day of the Kennedy administration and after the president died when Bobby stayed on at Justice. Bobby was, on paper, Hoover's boss. But Hoover wasn't following orders from him.
And there's been talk for many years, and you discussed this, the material, the information, the dossiers Hoover would have on someone like John F. Kennedy. How did he use that information?
Well, he only had one piece of hot scoop on John Kennedy, and he'd had it for 20 years. In 1942, the FBI was following a very interesting woman named Inga Arvad, very beautiful young woman who had, among other things, been Hitler's publicist at the 1936 Olympics. They thought she was a Nazi spy. And they followed her down from Washington. She met a young Navy lieutenant for an afternoon of pleasure at a hotel that weekend. That was John Kennedy. The FBI had bugged the hotel room. So Hoover let John Kennedy's father, Ambassador Joe Kennedy, who was a very close personal friend of his, know about this little assignation and the fact that it was on tape shortly thereafter. If Jack Kennedy's father knew, Jack Kennedy knew. So was this blackmail? Well, it takes two to tango if you want to blackmail somebody. Hoover thought he was doing Joe Kennedy a favor.
What about Hoover and Martin Luther King?
Hoover hated Martin Luther King with a deep and burning passion, not simply because Hoover was a racist, which he was, but because Hoover believed, and with good reason, that King's closest white confidant, speechwriter, ghostwriter of books, counselor, a man named Stanley Levison, had been a member of the secret communist underground in this country in the mid-50s. Not the Communist Party, the underground espionage network that reported to Moscow. And Hoover believed that the civil rights movement was, in effect, a cat's paw of communism. He was wrong about that. But his hatred for King grew deeper and deeper and deeper. And at the time King was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, Hoover and the FBI went all out to destroy him with sex tapes and other evidence that Dr. King had relations with women who are not his wife. No paper would print that, but he spread that dirt around, and President Johnson knew it.
Tim, is it possible for there to be another figure who amassed just the personal power and influence over our government and society that this one man did?
It will never happen again, and with good reason. Because that is not the way you run a secret intelligence service in an open democracy, with one man holding that much power for that long. The FBI is 103 years old, and there's reason for hope, because over the last 3 years, they have got this struggle, this balance struck between civil liberties and national security better than they ever have before. This is what they wake up to every day, this challenge. We want to be safe and we want to be free. We want our civil liberties and we want national security. And the struggle between liberty and security never ceases because they are opposing forces. The FBI has to get this right. And their director today, Bob Mueller, I believe, who has now served longer than any director since Hoover and will continue to serve through next year, really cares about this. He cares about getting this right. They're trying in a way that they've never done before to strike that balance. And that's an extraordinary thing.
Thanks so much, Tim.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Tim Weiner, whose new book, Enemies, A History of the FBI, is reviewed in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. So, Greg, a lot of movement on the lists this week.
Yeah, there's really a lot of turnover. We've got 10 new books on the fiction and nonfiction sides combined, five each, including new books at the top of both lists. In fiction, the new number one title is Harlan Coben's standalone domestic suspense thriller, Stay Close. Then at number three, a new book by C.J. Box, part of his series Mystery Thrillers. It's called Force of Nature. At number seven, another series thriller. This one's a spy thriller about Iran by a guy named Ted Bell, who's a writer in residence at Cambridge University. The name of the book is Phantom. At number 12, Suzanne Brockman wrote a futuristic paranormal romance thriller called Born to Darkness about a Navy SEAL who's been discharged and is now taking up with a group of psychics trying to defeat a drug taking over the world.
That book is already out. That was going to be my next book.
And last on the fiction side of things is a murder mystery by Richard North Patterson called Fall from Grace about a writer who dies in Martha's Vineyard and his CIA agent son trying to uncover what happened there.
And the other side, nonfiction.
Nonfiction, there's some interesting books. Maybe not the new book at number 13 by the director Kevin Smith, who made Clarks. I can't tell you the name of his new book. I can tell you the first word is tough, and the second word is we'll just leave it blank for right now. That's his advice for living large and explaining how he succeeded despite what he calls a lot of obstacles. Number 11 is a policy book called Why Nations Fail by somebody named Darren Acemoglu. I don't know how you pronounce his last name, with a co-writer, James Robinson. At number 9, Anne Lamott and her son Sam Lamott have a book, Some Assembly Required, that is kind of a follow-up to her big hit Operating Instructions, which was about Sam's first year of life. Now he's 22, but 3 years ago when he was 19, he became a father. And so this is looking at his son's first year of life, and Anne Lamott writes most of it about being a grandmother. Number seven, Cheryl Strayed's memoir, Wild, which is getting a lot of praise in a lot of places. It's her account of walking along the Pacific Crest Trail. That's new on the list at number seven. And new at number one this week is Jonah Lehrer's Imagine. He, of course, is the pop science writer, former neurology student, neuroscientist student, who dropped out of graduate school because he didn't like the lab work, but he got very interested in translating neuroscience for the lay reader. And this is his third book along those lines. It's all about how creativity works.
Number one, he may be the new Malcolm Gladwell.
A lot of people are comparing him to Gladwell, as a matter of fact. He takes these dense academic topics, finds real-world applications for them, and kind of digs into specific topics. His last book was about how we make decisions, also a very Gladwellian topic. And this one is how the imagination works.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.